Judge Larkin, Chief Judge Stegall, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's 27th day of April, 2023. We are ready for the two cases that are scheduled for oral argument this morning. The first is Waller versus Galloway Holdings. I've received communication indicating that counsel for respondents will split time 10 minutes by Mr. Varland and 5 minutes by Mr. Pope. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Excellent. Well, with that, we're ready for arguments from counsel for appellant. Please identify yourself for the record before beginning each leg of your argument this morning.
Thanks, Your Honor. Good morning. My name is Jared Gorlitz, and I represent the appellants. The appellants are here back behind me in the court. They were also the plaintiffs in the underlying lawsuit. May it please the court, counsel, the appellants seek to reverse the district court's order granting a motion to dismiss plaintiff's complaint as barred by the statute of limitations. Alternatively, it seeks to reverse that order because the district court failed to address the substantial prejudice caused to the appellants through the motion procedure, namely the new arguments raised in the reply. I would acknowledge there's a de novo review with respect to the motion to dismiss as to whether it should be granted in the first instance, and there's abuse of discretion with respect to the substantial prejudice argument raised by the appellants and the plaintiffs in the underlying lawsuit. I take a little different stance on this type of case because I fundamentally believe what happened at the district court level should not happen in our district court practice. We should not be here today. My client shouldn't have to wait 16 months just to start a lawsuit when a motion to dismiss on its face fails as a matter of law. And we're going to get into the nuances, but you know, a motion to dismiss, right? That means no facts, none, zero, can be introduced consistent with a complaint to support the relief requested. That's not the case here. We eluded facts that told the statute of limitations. We never have the ability to argue them, right? Why didn't we argue them? That's an issue for summary judgment. It's complicated. It's expensive. It's going to be a lot of work. What's the low-hanging fruit? You didn't satisfy the elements of your claim. Deny the motion. That's simple. And that gets back to rules of procedure. Why do we have Rule 115? It's supposed to create an efficient and fair process. There is nothing efficient and fair about what happened here. Not to mention, we say, hey, this is a new argument raised in a reply. They're now satisfying their elements, something they needed to do on the front end. And there's no record of any decision by the district court addressing that argument. How can that be the case?
For a moment, clarify, when you say there's no record of the district court addressing that argument, the one you're referring to now is substantial prejudice?
Correct.
Am I right?
Okay. Yes.
So when it comes to which arguments the district court did address, the district court did address the timeliness of your claim under the statute of limitations, right?
Yep.
Okay. And as I recall the sequence of events, so obviously an affirmative defense, it's filed by the motion to dismiss is filed by respondents, Galloway, and then it's your response that interjected the how the statute should be correctly interpreted, I guess, is how I would put it very broadly. Is that fair?
I think it's very fair, Your Honor.
Okay. And so then we have the reply argument.
Yes.
Right? And as I understand it, it's the district court considering the reply argument by Galloway that you're really objecting to. Am I right?
100%.
Okay. Yes. So tell me why.
Well, first of all, the district court should not be considering an essential element of a claim solely in a reply. And I take it back to Rule 41. I'm a litigator.
When you use that terminology, essential element of a claim, it confuses me a bit. You're talking about an affirmative defense. I guess you could generally say an affirmative defense is a claim, but it's actually the plaintiffs that are making the claim here, right?
Sure.
Okay.
So let me answer your question directly, because this is directly from the case and one of the things that bother me about this. So Thiel and Stitch, it's in my brief. I've referenced it a number of times. It says, specifically, and I'm quoting, one asserting the statute of limitations also has the burden of proving all the elements of the affirmative defense. So then I simply just turn to the statute and I read it, right? This is their defense. It's their statute. And what does it say? And it basically says, upon discovery of the injury, and I can read it if you want, but upon the discovery of the injury, right? Comma.
Right.
But
there are two potential triggers, right? For accrual of a statute of limitations argument,
yes,
under this two-year statute.
Yes.
Could be discovery. You argue this eloquently, I think, in your reply brief. Could be discovery, or it could be, what's the alternative?
Substantial completion.
Right.
Right.
Could be either one. The argument by Galloway started with discovery. You interjected substantial completion in your response, saying, no, that's more appropriate in this case.
I argue it this way. I think you have to address both. Because when the language says, upon discovery of the injury, comma, but in no event, don't we have to go to the event, right? Because it's upon the discovery of the injury, but then we still have this other part of the statute that the legislature added, and they added it for a reason, and they don't apply to this case. Ironically, I was reading some cases the other day, and the concern, as I understand it, and this is outside the record, but I think it provides some context. The concern was the statute of limitations would begin to accrue, and then these projects wouldn't even be complete, and the statute of limitations would have run. That would have been kind of an absurd result type thing. But that's rather here nor there. But when I read it, it says, upon discovery of the injury, but in no event. So that means you have to address the rest of it, because there is no situation where it can only be upon the date of the discovery, because
happens after substantial completion, then discovery might be the only relevant date, correct?
It might.
It's not your case. It's
not
a different
case. Yeah. But that's why I say, when it says, but in no event, I don't know how we can just ignore that. They want to ignore it, and I'm saying the statute as written requires them as an element of their defense to address it.
Right, and counsel, if you're right about that, that that's the way the statute works and should be interpreted, it seems like the district court didn't disagree with you, because the district court's analysis does turn on substantial completion.
Correct.
Then it seems to me that the heart of your argument on the first issue turns on whether the district court abused its discretion in considering the substantial completion argument that Galloway made in their reply brief. Am I right, or do I have that argument wrong?
I would say you have it partially right,
okay,
but here's where you have it wrong, Your Honor. I would like this court to address what I believe is an erosion of the rules with respect to reply briefs. To me, reply briefs were supposed to be very limited. They've been around a long time, and that has eroded into these. Sometimes I see reply briefs longer than an opening brief. They've turned into this crazy procedural potential gamesmanship. I'm not saying that happened here, but reply briefs have been eroded, and all this stuff comes in the reply. And if you look at the Court of Appeals decisions that I know the respondents are going to talk about, they're going to say, well, all these issues came up in replies, and the district courts considered them and all that. But my point is, back to the front end of this, I would like this court to say, when a party does not meet its burden of proof in its opening brief, which is the argument here, we can simply say, you fail to meet your burden of proof, the motion's denied, and you can't come in and raise new issues in the reply. So the de novo review is, we don't consider the reply. That should have been stricken, because as a fundamental part of motion practice, they didn't meet the elements of their defense. They can't start with the discovery date without addressing substantial compliance or substantial completion.
And counsel, I think if there was no ambiguity or discretion involved in determining what a new argument is in reply, you might have a case. I struggle to go in your direction, because I just don't think it rests on a fundamentally correct view of what is a new reply in an argument.
Well,
or a new argument and a reply brief. But let's just set that aside.
Okay.
What if this court disagrees with you on that first premise, that reply briefs should be narrowly interpreted, and therefore the district court sort of simply struck Galloway's motion entirely? What if we disagree about that?
Yes.
So do you lose this appeal completely?
No, because the district court abused its discretion by not addressing our repeated arguments to it that, hey, they've raised something in a reply, and we should now be allowed to address that, because we have additional defenses here to substantial completions.
Well, okay, so that I thought that might be your answer. So what I'm not clear about is, you're talking about your estoppel defense, right?
Yes.
Am I right?
Yep.
Okay. So why didn't you raise that in response to Galloway's opening argument? Because it applies to any aspect of the statute of limitations as applying to your client.
Correct. Because it gets back to the belief that an element of their affirmative defense was that there was a discovery date and that they also had to have established a substantial completion. And because they didn't establish substantial completion, we shouldn't have to anticipate that they're going to do so in a reply. It should have been addressed on the front end. Let's not forget, it was right there in front of them. It was in the complaint. Nothing new came up in the reply. In fact, I mean, it's turned around on us as, how come you didn't anticipate this argument almost? And it's like, why do we have to anticipate something that's on the face of the complaint, should have been argued in the opening brief, and we, as a fundamental of procedure, should have been allowed to address it? And let's narrow this.
When should you have been allowed to address it, I guess?
Well, they should have addressed it in their opening brief, and then we would have addressed it in our response.
Remember, though, we disagree with that. At least, for the sake of argument, we disagree with that view of the rules and the district court discretion. So at what point did the district court abuse its discretion then?
At the time of the hearing, after we had already raised the issue via letter, and we raised the issue at the hearing, and we said, Your Honor, it's our position, this has been raised in a reply brief. We've not had the ability to respond to this. We have a number of arguments that were made. We told them in the letter. We told them at oral argument. And we're being unfairly prejudiced. And those were the words used. That's the words used in the letter. We cited to the case law that says this was a new argument. Now we should be allowed to address this. District court never responded to our request. To me, when the district court doesn't respond, and I got into this in my reply a little bit, there isn't a bunch of case law on this, but to me it's an abuse of discretion not to address our argument. I don't think it should be appropriate for a district court for somebody to raise an argument like this and then they can just ignore it. The district court, at a minimum here, it should be remanded to say, district court, you got to rule on their argument. Never did. So, but I think the district courts should, in this instance, especially if the court's view of disagrees with my view on reply memorandums, and we're going to broadly interpret new arguments and new facts, then the district court should be ready to grant sir replies, right? And so in this instance, I fully expected a judge that was grappling with these issues would have been very careful and said, I see your argument, counsel. I'm going to give the opportunity to supplement the record before I consider my argument, and we would have filed a sir reply. And
counsel,
that's how it should have been done.
Can you explain to me, I mean, as I understand this, filed a complaint, motion to dismiss, Rule 12, statute of limitations.
Yep.
Now you're talking about respondents' burden of proof on that issue.
Yep.
So they file a motion, they assert, I mean, were there documents, were there exhibits, or did they just write a brief saying, here's what we understand the facts to be, we're past the statute of limitations?
They relied on my complaint. No additional declarations to my knowledge. And
so explain to me what their burden of proof is. So you're saying their burden is to put in their supporting memorandum reference to substantial compliance and a couple of lines saying it was or wasn't completed.
Correct, yep. Yeah, because it's an affirmative defense, right? If we went to trial, in theory, put on my case in chief, and then they're going to put on their case in chief, and if they don't meet the elements of their affirmative defense, it's their burden, right? I could make a motion for a directed verdict. Please strike their affirmative defense. They have the burden. And I just read the case, Your Honor. It says they have the burden. I'm just reading directly from the Stitch case here. An affirmative defense is a burden. There it is. One asserting the statute of limitations also has the burden of proving all the elements of that affirmative defense, right? We have
But we're not talking about a situation where they didn't prove it or didn't address it. It's just merely they did it in the reply brief instead of the initial brief.
Correct.
Where is the harm there?
We never got the opportunity to address the additional arguments they made in their reply brief, which is why I'm saying, Your Honor, hey, they didn't meet their elements.
So you had an opportunity to address substantial compliance, but not to specifically address the arguments they made in the reply brief.
I said, kind of like a Rule 41 motion, this is what I say. They had the burden. They didn't meet your burden, Your Honor. They didn't address all the elements. Grant me a directed verdict that their affirmative defense is denied. They only address the discovery rule. They don't address substantial completion. That was our opposition. They haven't met their burden of proof, right? We're turning kind of plaintiff and defendant on its head, but that's what the law is, right? It's an affirmative defense. It's their burden. They need to carry it. And we said, you haven't met your burden. Motion should be denied. Then they come in and say, oh, well, we do have our burden met. We do have some staff completion. Here's our argument. I'm now out, right? I don't have a SIR reply. I don't have any opportunity to file anything. I know some people don't follow the rules of procedure and file a bunch of stuff, but that's not what the rules say. My reading of the rules is I go to the judge and I say, Your Honor, this came in the reply. We should have the opportunity to respond to it. We've been substantially prejudiced because we haven't had the ability to respond to it. Here's why. And we did that. Did that in a letter. We did that at the district court oral argument. Judge said, well, if I think, you know, you should have the ability to do that, I'll give you the opportunity to do so. Silence, motion for request for reconsideration. No.
I think Judge Siegel has a question.
Yeah. Sorry. So maybe you could respond to this on, you know, in your rebuttal. But if they had brief substantial compliance in their initial brief, how does that alter things in the sense, particularly you mentioned estoppel, your estoppel argument that we're not barred by the statute because of estoppel. How do they relate? I mean, how did that not, and you did argue it orally at least, estoppel, right? And it's in your complaint.
How does that relate? It tolls the statute of limitations. So
I understand the estoppel but how does that relate to your, or does it, did the fact that their substantial completion argument was only in the reply brief impact what you did in your brief on the estoppel issue?
10,000%. I don't want to open Dandora's box to a bunch of complicated facts and a bunch of expense which would involve the tolling of the statute of limitations. They made a simple argument. I said it's wrong, doesn't meet your burden as a matter of law. I'm not going to put a bunch of time, money, and expense, which the rules say I shouldn't do, and telling you why, how I'm going to respond to substantial completion. And really, to me, it's questions of fact. It's really a summary judgment issue. And likely my response is, see, we've alluded to it in our complaint. We believe that we have a defense tolling the statute of limitations, and it's going to be a question for discovery and an issue for summary judgment really down the road, would have been the response. I never got there, never got the opportunity to make that argument.
So your complaint really is with the procedure in that you did not have an opportunity to do sir rebuttal and develop your estoppel theory. So having that opportunity cures the problem.
Correct.
Thank you. Your time is up. You'll have your 5 minutes on rebuttal.
Thank you.
So now we'll hear from Mr. Varland. Okay. And do identify yourself for the record before you begin.
Good morning, Your Honors, Counsel. May it please the court, my name is Brian Varland, and I'm here on behalf of Respondent Galloway Holdings, LLC, DBA Stone River Homes. And we respectfully request that the court affirm the district court's judgment in its entirety. As was outlined on by opposing counsel, this case concerns the pleading admissions of substantial completion in the complaint in this case. It concerns a situation in which substantial completion through an allegation of certificates of occupancy was alleged in the complaint itself. It's a time frame that was nearly 3 years before the commencement of this lawsuit. Minnesota Statute Section 541.051 Subdivision 1 provides a 2-year statute of limitations. There is no dispute based on the pleading in the record that the pleading was untimely. The pleading itself contains admissions of these facts. As far as the arguments raised by the appellants today and in the briefing, we respectfully offer that the district court did correctly dismiss the time-barred action pursuant to Rule 1202E. That is a de novo review. And the district court also did not abuse its discretion in applying Rule 115.03 to the party's briefing on this dismissal motion. That is an abuse of discretion standard, as the court has made clear. As far as the issues that have been raised by opposing counsel this morning, I do have a few responses to that could help the court, in my opinion. As far as the idea of There was a question about two potential triggers under the statute. The one is discovery of the injury, and the other, as was noted, is under subdivision 1C, it talks about, but in no event does a cause of action accrue earlier than substantial completion. I would read that provision to understand that discovery is still the accrual time, but that it can possibly toll the time for the starting of the clock based on substantial completion. Now, as far as the issues that were put in the original Rule 12 motion, we respectfully disagree that the issue was not raised in the motion. The statute of limitations in this particular subdivision was raised in the Rule 1202E motion. And the court is correct in raising the very reasonable question of, was there not an opportunity in a brief in opposition to raise the issue of estoppel simultaneously with relying on the substantial completion element of subdivision 1C? And that is a fair question. All the arguments being raised on this appeal now could have been raised in that brief in opposition. Essentially, substantial completion.
Your argument that appellant is barred from raising its estoppel issue, even though it's in their complaint and they argued it? And if so, why?
Your Honor, that is correct. That issue could have been raised in the brief in opposition, but it is barred because estoppel is not found within the four corners of the pleading. The initial burden in this case is the party to state a claim upon which relief can be granted in the pleading itself. The pleading itself does not allege the causes of action and claims talked about in the briefing on this appeal. There is no reference to estoppel. There is no reference to detrimental reliance. That would have had to have been in the pleading.
There is a reference to the French drain system that was installed, correct?
You are correct, Your Honor.
So that's in there.
There is a reference to attempts to repair, but that's a different question than whether those attempts to repair were a part of a conversation on which a party detrimentally
but
relied.
But it's a Rule 12. It's just a complaint. I mean, you don't have to put, under pleading standards in Minnesota, you don't have to put every fact into your complaint.
I acknowledge that, Your Honor. It is a notice pleading state. It still remains a notice pleading state under the Walsh decision. However, for purposes of having a sufficient showing to make the complaint timely under the statute of limitations, there needed to have been something within the complaint itself to demonstrate why this lawsuit was not commenced within 2 years of substantial completion, which is in the complaint itself. It acknowledges certificates of completion.
And what's your best authority for that? That all facts relating to a statute of limitations or estoppel or tolling of a statute have to actually be on the face of the complaint?
Your Honor, I think the authorities I would refer the court to in particular are those in our brief. It's the Park Nicollet Clinic versus Heyman case, 808 Northwest 2nd, 828 from 2011. That's the Minnesota Supreme Court. And the Minnesota Supreme Court's decision in the Hansen versus U.S. Bank National Association, that's 934 Northwest 2nd, 319. That's a 2019 case, Your Honor.
Counsel, it's your position that both of those cases, Minnesota Supreme Court has said a plaintiff must establish the timeliness of their complaint by allegations in the complaint, timeliness under the statute of limitations?
Your Honor, I will refer the court to what those decisions state. I don't want to mischaracterize them. I also should know that it appears that my time is up, so I'll defer to fellow counsel.
True enough. May I ask just one question? I forgot how you were dividing the time. I apologize. And if you don't mind having one additional question. You mentioned whether it was fair for the district court to consider Galloway's argument on behalf, and you do represent Galloway, correct?
That's correct,
yeah,
Your Honor.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I was asking the right lawyer. Whether it was fair for the district court to consider the reply argument that was made about substantial completion, right? I mean, you feel it is, right?
Yes.
It was fair for the
That's
district
right.
court to do that. So I guess what I am confused about and want to hear your view on is, wouldn't it have also been fair for the district court to have allowed the plaintiffs here, the appellant, to have replied to your substantial completion argument, even though under the rules they weren't given an opportunity to file an additional brief. So fair as in fair at the time of the summary judgment hearing, because that's where they specifically made an estoppel argument.
Your Honor, I disagree with the idea that they did not have an opportunity.
I know you do. I'm asking about fairness.
Fairness.
Right.
Your Honor, I think the time to have, there was an opportunity at the hearing to raise the issue. As well, I don't know if necessarily it would have changed the outcome. A question was raised by the panel
right,
earlier.
Right, and I'm not asking about changing the outcome. I am not asking whether the district court had discretion to refuse. I'm saying, was it fair to extend that opportunity to Galloway and then to not extend an opportunity to the plaintiffs? And if not, why not? Or if so, why so? Either way, whichever way you want to go.
Your Honor, the time to present the arguments was in the order of briefing under Rule 115. The court exercised its discretion in reviewing the arguments made in the briefings and also exercised its discretion and considered it to be fair for Galloway to present the same issue of the subdivision of the same statute in both briefs in response to what was mentioned in the brief in opposition and also disregard what was raised post reply brief, but before the hearing and at the time of the hearing. Thank you, Your Honor.
I have a question for you.
Okay.
Everything I'm hearing is far more of a substance, and I can't believe this is what we're doing this morning. But here we are, and I've just got to ask this, and maybe I don't understand it, but it sounds like you're saying plaintiffs did not say collateral estoppel in their complaint. Therefore, they can't talk about that when we're before the judge. The other side saying, well, respondents didn't write about substantial completion in their brief. Therefore, they shouldn't be allowed to talk about it for the district court. It seems like you're both accusing each other of the same fault. So it's like, why should plaintiff not get to talk about estoppel if it's not clearly set out in their brief, but you get to talk about substantial compliance, even though you didn't talk about that in your initial brief?
Your Honor, Rule 12 is clear. The cases are clear about you look within the four corners. We can't go outside the four corners of the pleading. The pleading itself raised claims that by their own allegations accrued in 2018 and no later. And so we have raised the statute of limitations as the defense in the brief. We raised the correct statute, correct subdivision, no one disputes that's the correct subdivision. The briefing under Rule 115 is a different question about how a court has the discretion to address the arguments of the statute's application. The memo in opposition had raised substantial completion. And it was a new matter for which a reply brief was appropriate under Rule 115. Thank you, Your Honor.
You may approach the podium. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Your Honor. My name is Stephen Pope. I represent James and Amy Loria. May it please the court, Mr. Varlin, Mr. Zhang, Mr. Gorlitz. I agreed with everything Mr. Varlin just said. I'm going to add two additional arguments or things I would like to note. And the first thing I'd like to note is the appropriateness of the reply memorandum under the appellate case law. And the second...
And you're talking about the Galloway reply memorandum, right?
Correct, Your Honor.
Because you didn't file a reply memorandum or an opening memorandum. You just joined in the argument by letter, right?
That is correct, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
And for the sake of the court, when I'm referring to respondents, I will be referring to them in the collective during this conversation. And the second topic I'd like to address is the theory of estoppel as it relates to Amy and James Loria. Now, with respect to the first issue of the appropriateness of the reply memorandum, Minnesota General Rule of Practice 115.03 says that a reply memorandum must be limited to new factual or legal matters. And fortunately, we have some guidance from the case law, specifically the Gomez case and the Bradley case, to tell us what is appropriate and what is not appropriate. And I won't belabor those cases given the time I have, but there are striking similarities in one important distinction or an important distinction between those cases that I believe warrants the court to affirm the decision of the district court. In both Bradley and Gomez, the Minnesota Court of Appeals noted that the plaintiff appellants had an opportunity, an ample opportunity, to raise the new issues in the reply memorandum at issue. That happened in this case, too. Appellants argued both in a letter submitted the day before the hearing and on the day of the hearing about the reply memorandum and estoppel. The most important thing I would like to draw the court's attention to about Bradley and Gomez are the differences between those cases and this case. This case involves the statute of limitations being asserted in the initial memorandum and then in the reply memorandum. In Gomez, in the initial memorandum, the defendant respondent relied on the statute of limitations and then in the reply memorandum pivoted to the statute of repose. In Bradley, the respondent didn't even mention the statute of limitations in the initial brief and then pivoted to it in the reply memorandum, given the arguments that the other party made in their opposition motion. In this case, there was no pivot from the statute of limitations to the statute of repose. Everything centered on the statute of limitations. And so in Gomez and Bradley, there's even more flexibility allowed between the initial and reply memoranda, and I ask that the court follow those decisions. With respect to the second topic of estoppel, if we set aside the issue of the reply memorandum and look at estoppel, there's nothing in the complaint or in any of the arguments before the district court or this court that lays out an argument for estoppel against James and Amy Loria.
So, counsel, if you would address, the complaint does allege the repair efforts and just says that happened in 2019, it's the French drains, it was done by Galloway in an attempt to address this water flow problem, and it didn't work, right? I think that's a fair paraphrase of what's in the complaint.
I agree with that,
Your Honor. Those are factual allegations, which is normally in Minnesota, that's all we require, right? Notice pleading. So why isn't that sufficient as a basis for the appellants to now, and plaintiffs when they're in district court, say, we're alleging estoppel based on those facts?
Two reasons, Your Honor. The first is, while it is notice pleading, the party, the defendants, have to be given notice that a claim is being brought against them. And I think if you read the complaint, especially with respect to the Loria defendants, respondents, they can't read that complaint and know that an estoppel claim is being argued against them.
Is estoppel a claim in this case, or is it sort of a defense of pleading? I mean, that they file a suit, you say it's time-barred, they come back and say, well, that's, no, I'm claiming estoppel. Do they have to proactively plead estoppel when no one's challenged?
Your Honor, that's a good segue to the second point I was going to make. And
is there an answer before the segue?
Yeah. Fair point, Your Honor. I think they have to plead facts that alert the other side that estoppel is a potential argument that will be made, and I think that was lacking in this case. But more importantly, there is no mention of the Loria defendants in the complaint. There's no argument in any of the briefs that the Loria defendants made any representation, which is an essential element of estoppel. I'll take more questions, Your Honor, but my time is up.
So thank you for your answer and your argument.
Thank you. May it please the court. The first thing I want to address is this concept about we have to plead facts regarding our response to an affirmative defense that would come after we file our complaint. The only case law that I found really that addresses this issue was out of the Federal District Court here in Minnesota. It's in my reply brief on page 4, and it's the Aquilar versus Aquin case. And the law, as stated in that case, is clear that a plaintiff need not plead facts responsive to an affirmative defense before the defense is raised. So to Judge Larkin's comment here, right, don't they need to raise affirmative defense and then you can come back and say estoppel? Yes, that's exactly how it was anticipated to work. We did put that fact in there because we knew this was going to be an issue. And so we anticipated fighting over estoppel. We didn't anticipate being here. I do want to comment briefly, though, on the argument that they waited 3 years to find their case. It was a 2-year statute of limitations. It's more complicated than that. I know we tend to forget about COVID in different ways, shapes, or forms, but it was real. It impacted everybody's lives, and more importantly, the legislature recognized that. What did they do? They actually told the statute of limitations by statute. It was argued at the district court level. There was a change at the legislature that basically made it didn't just toll it till whenever. They basically had a hard cutoff, which is fine. The point, though, and the reality.
Right. And if you don't mind, counsel, if I could just ask a quick question on that. The district court does analyze that in laying out in the memorandum about at what point that pandemic legislation, you know, ceased tolling the time for the statute of limitations in your case. You didn't raise any of that in your appellate brief. You aren't disagreeing with the district court's analysis on that?
I disagree, but I didn't raise it because it doesn't matter.
It's not an issue before this court.
Correct.
Okay.
But what I did want to say
sure.
is based on the district court's analysis, Your Honor, this isn't like, we only need 7 months. So the facts and the complaint are, okay, discovery, November. Right? Well, we know in Minnesota, you're not building a French train in 2019 in January, February, March, April, maybe May, maybe June. My point is, we don't need to get very far to toll the statute of limitations to have a claim. This isn't some pipe dream that, you know, we're grasping at straws and we're just trying to throw a few crumbs into the complaint to try to get past this stage. It's real. And that's only the French train. At oral argument and in our letter, there's also curb and gutter that the city said. And I understand I'm adding this to the record, but it was argued at oral. The city added curb and gutter to address this issue, too. That's also part of this tolling the statute of limitations. My clients believed this was going to be addressed and resolved, and it took a number of years for that to actually happen. Briefly on the Gomez and Bradley case, I think two things are important when we talk about those cases. Number one, they deal with motions for summary judgment and not motions to dismiss. I think that's a very important distinction. Number two, if you look at Gomez and Bradley, these are cases that went on for a number of months. There was discovery. There were a lot of opportunities for the parties through the discovery and litigation process to address these claims. And most importantly, why the district court ultimately allowed the argument in the reply was based on everything in the record to date, after discovery and after a number of months, showed that that defense was going to win, even if the court allowed a surreply. That's not the case here. We have a fact in our complaint. We directly pled to address this issue. We argued it before the court. And for sure, at a motion to dismiss stage, right, what's the standard? No facts exist to support your claim. I think we have some facts here. I think we've talked about them extensively. Unless there are any questions, I'll close up my argument that we believe the district court decision should be reversed and we should be allowed to proceed with our claim. It should either be directly reversed by a denial of the motion to dismiss or reversed as abuse of discretion to allow us to file a reply and address the substantial completion argument and raise our tolling of the statute of limitations. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your arguments and your brief.